The Laura Murphy Show, Episode 2.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everybody, to Episode 2 of The Laura Murphy Show. I'm one of your hosts, Bob Murphy, and with me, as always, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how you doing?
I'm doing fantastic. How are you, Bob?
I'm doing great.
Good.
Well, except for the stock market. Oh, wait, I'm fine because I wasn't in the stock market. Now, folks, this is going to be part two. This is sort of like if you ever watched the Incredible Hulk TV series. The first episode, it was broken up into two parts. It was sort of the pilot. It had to give you the background so you understood how is it that this guy, when he gets angry, turns into this big green monster. That's kind of what we're doing here. These first two episodes, there's a lot of background that we need to give you so you understand the framework for when we finally get into what we think the normal rhythm of this podcast is going to be. And just to anticipate that, we're going to be interpreting the financial news of the day through the lenses of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. But again, in these first two episodes, we thought we should explain who we are, how we came together, and what is this infrastructure we have in place for which this podcast is just one of the methods of outreach to the public, if you will. So to recap last episode, episode one, we talked about how we met. We talked about my background as an academic economist affiliated with the Austrian school, Carlos's background as a business consultant, a workout specialist, and how we both, through various historical routes, ended up studying and appreciating Austrian theory, especially about the business cycle. And we wrapped up talking about what we call building the 10%. That's the motto on the top left of the Laura Murphy Report, our financial publication. And we said how ultimately we follow Mises when he says public opinion is decisive when it comes to government policy. And we believe the Austrians are correct when they diagnose what causes the business cycle. We think it's because of bad central banking policy and, in fact, having a central bank in the first place. We think money and banking should be returned to the private sector. But to get to there, we need to educate the public. The problem is that these are very esoteric, dry subjects, and any individual person realizes, well, even if I do study all this stuff, if I read Human Action, I read Murray Rothbard's work, I alone can't change anything. Even if 1,000 of us get angry and go march on Washington, that's not going to do anything. So there's sort of a feeling of helplessness. And that was the beauty of what Carlos originally thought of and what made us write our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works, is he saw that if we can show people Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, in a way, metaphorically, you can become your own banker and implement a form of privatized banking by which you secede from this establishment system that everybody else is using, and you can sort of shield yourself largely from what's going on around you, and then you directly experience some of the benefits of what would happen if more generally we really did have a broad privatized banking and monetary system. And so that's where we ended, saying that this was our method of trying to educate the public was not just merely academic, but showing them things that would directly benefit them financially. And then each person would have an incentive to really study it and adopt it. And then once the person saw how it was working in his or her own life, would naturally want to share it with friends and family and coworkers. So that's where we ended up. But we left out a key part of the story last episode just because of the constraints of time. So now that I've brought you back up to speed, why don't I turn over to Carlos? So Carlos, what there am I missing? What is the crucial conduit in that diffusion of the information process that we left out last time?
Okay, well, Bob, I think you've laid it out very clearly, but at the same time, I think we have to be honest with everybody. There's a lot of terms flying around and a lot of concepts trying to absorb. And of course, at some point in some of these podcasts, we need to describe the infinite banking concept, which is really the dynamic, you know, idea, the real turnaround dynamics that's involved in the 10%. Our listeners need to understand what a powerful message that is, because it's an integral part of actually building this 10% that we keep talking about. So it's important, though, as we discuss this particular movement, if you will, to maybe put it in the context of things that we've seen happen historically. So, for example, if you think of Christianity, the religion, the faith, Christianity, it started out in the minds and hearts of just a few individuals. And before long, it became the world religion of the most powerful empire in the world at that time, which was Rome, the Roman Empire. And of course, Christianity is more or less the basis for our Western civilization. So here we have something that has occurred historically where an unshakable belief held with just the minority of people within time became the thinking of the majority. Now, that would be a historical piece of evidence to see that this idea of the 10%, you know, has actually worked. We also talked about the tipping point, which comes from the book that Gladwell wrote here recently, a very popular book, The Tipping Point, which talked about how small things can grow into very big, powerful things. So it is important to realize that this 10% is not just a randomly picked percentile. Also, in 2010, the scientists at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute of New York did a study, and they wound up saying the very same thing, that when an unshakable belief is held by only 10% of the people, it becomes the majority's belief. So this idea of growing the 10%, you know, is very much a doable thing now, but it's got to have some sort of driving force, some sort of power to drive it. And as what we explained in our last podcast, is that it's the idea that with Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, which we keep calling a form of privatized banking, when we bring that message to individuals, it really helps them. It helps them in that it helps them releases them from the financial stranglehold that they're in. And that's this financial stranglehold that not only individuals are in, our whole economy's in that kind of financial stranglehold. So this message actually helps an individual, and because it helps them and it gives them an immediate benefit, they in turn will tell others about it. And that's the message then is not just about education, not just about Austrian economics, the free market. It's now an incentivized message. Now, what you more or less did leave out, Bob, and I think we need to sort of address is in the last episode, we said that we have a lot of nonprofit organizations, which are, you know, educational institutes that are teaching free market principles. We have the Mises Institute down in Auburn. We have the Acton Institute up in Michigan. We've got the Independent Institute out on the West Coast in San Francisco. So we have many of these type of educational institutes out there. And they've been around for over 60 years. But still, what we see is the one adversary that we have that is really destroying the free market, capitalism, acting more like a parasite, you know, on capitalism is socialism. And so the educational message is talking about this to individuals, to students, and yet when the recipient of this education receives this information, as you said yesterday, I mean, the last time we had the podcast, you said the individual asked the question, well, this is all great news and everything. This is great education, but what does that do for me? So until the message really does something for the individual, there's no incentive to really pass on that message. And what we discovered is that the ideal individual to partner up with the educational institutes is the financial professional. And the reason for that is because here are individuals who are speaking with people about their money.
Well, let me stop you there for a second, Carlos, just to make sure the listeners are catching this, because that's really the money point here. The money quote is this, and this was Carlos's idea, so I'm just going to make sure everyone gets it, and then he can take the helm back, is to say that instead of just these beacons of truth broadcasting stuff to the masses, I mean, this stuff gets really complicated, and later on in this particular episode, we'll give you just a taste of exactly what do we mean by this IBC, so we'll open up the hood a little bit and let you know what we're talking about, but you'll see it can get pretty complicated just to understand all the little details and terminology. The idea itself is very simple, and we realize that it's tricky, especially when it comes to people's money. They don't necessarily just trust something on their own. They feel like they need a personalized guide. And so this is, you know, what Carlos realized is we have to somehow harness and bring in financial professionals, people whose job it is to sit down with people, perhaps in their homes, or the people go to the offices of these financial professionals and talk to them about their money. And Carlos realized that is the group of people that we need to get on our side, to let them understand about Austrian economics and how IBC can be used. It's not enough to go after academia, for example. We could get all the college professors in the world on our side, but if everybody's CPA and a broker and so forth are a bunch of Keynesians, then that's going to kind of cancel it out. So I'll turn it back over to you, Carlos.
Okay, so that's correct. And because, you know, I was a broker dealer myself, so I've gone through all this the educational training that a broker dealer is required to have, dealing with all kinds of financial products up there. So I'm very familiar with all the financial products that are available out there. But when I say that it's the financial professional that is the ideal partner with these educational institutes to take the message of the free market to individuals, there's also a problem there. And here's where that problem is. We discovered that there are approximately 750,000 financial professionals in our economy. And at the time we did that analysis, we hadn't even included CPAs and attorneys who many times also talk to people about money. If you just take the attorneys by themselves, there's over 1 million of those. And there's approximately almost 400,000 certified public accountants. So there could be as many as 2 million financial professionals in the economy. But there's overlap in some of the licenses that these individuals have. And so the 750,000 is probably about the best conservative number for the number of financial professionals in the economy. Now, where the problem is here is I would venture to say that almost 95% of them, if not 100% of them, have been schooled in Keynesian economics. And I know that because that's what I was taught in school. Because just about every university from Harvard on down to the smallest community college is vested in this type of education. This is the education that our political leaders have and our central bankers have. And so if you unleash these financial professionals on the general public, in a way, you're making the problem worse. And so what we decided that we must do is that we needed to handpick at least 10% of those 750,000 financial professionals, handpick them so that we have a basis of 75,000 of them, and, you know, grow them into, an elite force. And that group of financial professionals would be trained and taught and educated in the free market and in specifically Austrian economics, in combination with the message of IBC. Now, a group that has been educated that way and has and carries with them the message of IBC now can be very effective at really dealing with people's financial situation and bringing the benefits that they need and keep the message moving forward.
Yes, exactly. So that's what we ended up doing. And just to give people the timeline here, so Carlos and I wrote our book, How Privatized Banking Really Works. And at this point, we were part of the community of people who were really big fans of the infinite banking concept, IBC. And Carlos had been friends with Nelson Nash and David Stearns longer than he introduced them to me, literally introduced them to me. And so we were in that community, and that's what we were talking more with David Stearns and Nelson Nash, and we ultimately, the four of us, came together to form what is called the IBC Practitioner Program. And all of this information, folks, you can find various introductory pieces and then in-depth analysis at our website, which again is laramurphy.com, and that's Murphy.com, M-U-R-P-H-Y.com. We have all this stuff here, but we're just pointing you towards it in this verbal format on the podcast. So that's really what led us to do that. And there was very in-depth analysis. We did all sorts of research and preparation for this program, getting insurance textbooks, paying visits to life insurance companies, the home offices, interviewing actuaries, and so on. Because Nelson Nash is becoming your own banker is written for the general public, whereas we realized if we're going to train financial professionals both in Austrian economics and knowing how to present IBC to their clients, they need something more in-depth than just the book that the general public gets. And so that was the function of our program. And ultimately, we have a whole list now of graduates from the program who are authorized IBC practitioners that we are comfortable with and are knowing that they can present the public. And if somebody's interested in what we say, they go to these people, and that's who they sit down with and say, how do I make this work in my own life? All right, why don't we, Carlos, at this point, we're getting close to the two-thirds mark for this particular episode, so why don't we transition now in the remaining time we have. People have been listening. They're on the edge of their seats. They're saying, you keep talking about this IBC. I can become my own banker. It's the solution. What is it? How does it work? So maybe you and I can just take a few cracks at this to at least give them a taste. So, because folks, this isn't like some infomercial where we're going to keep stringing you along and then hit you with the thing at the end. We want to tell you up front exactly what this is. And then as these episodes unroll, you'll learn more and more of the details. But why don't we right now, Carlos, let the cat out of the bag and tell them exactly what the heck is IBC?
Like it was that easy, right? There are so many ways that we can attempt to try to explain IBC, and I'm not sure one is easier than the other, Bob. I think if I had to try to explain it from scratch, I would probably have to say that what this is an alternate cash flow management system that is alternate from the cash flow system that all of us use, which is commercial banks. both businesses and individuals deposit either their revenue or their paychecks into a commercial bank, into their checking account. And so it becomes the first stop for their money. And from that bank account, an individual or a business will make disbursements out of it. And many times may even use a line of credit with the commercial bank, or even take out loans during the period of time that he's got that bank account. So IBC is an alternate cash flow management system that is set up by using, of all things, a dividend-paying whole life insurance policy. Now, that's bare bones, bare facts, what this is. Now, what we need to understand, and we probably have to take it in steps, is that the dividend-paying whole life insurance policy, which was the original insurance product for all insurance carriers besides term insurance, is actually a very boring product. There's not much to it. The formula is pretty basic, pretty straightforward. But every whole life policy, of course, has borrowing privileges. And so the terms that you're able to have in a dividend paying whole life policy are so flexible and really unlike any other type of loan that you might borrow from any other type of institution or even a commercial bank. So those particular features make it an ideal cash flow management system. Now that's just picking one of the items that's very, very key and very important. But there are many other attributes to the dividend paying whole life policy, which act as additional bonuses, making it the ideal cash flow management tool.
Okay, that's a good start there. Let me make sure we're not losing anybody, because again, this stuff is new, and I think, you know, Carlos, you're a tad older than I am, and so maybe you don't appreciate the generational gap as much as I do, that I literally had I'm not saying this to be a braggart or something, I had a PhD in economics, I know what I'm talking, and I really didn't know what a whole life insurance policy was. And for some of our listeners, they might resonate with this might resonate with them. I remember watching the famous Christmas movie, It's a Wonderful Life, and in the beginning, there's the bank run, you know, and Jimmy Stewart is in trouble. And what does he do when he tries to come up with some asset when he goes to the rich local banker guy? He goes in and he hands over, he says, "Well, I got this life insurance policy. What can that get me?" And I remember at the time when I first saw that movie watching that and thinking, what the heck? How does a life insurance policy have money? Because to me, you know, I drove a car. I had car insurance. It wasn't like I was saving wealth inside my car insurance policy. Well, the difference is when it comes to life insurance, as Carlos said, there's two different types. There's term insurance, which is just a very straightforward transaction where you pay premiums to the life insurance company for a set term. It might be 1 year, it might be 5 years, it might be 10, it might be 20, it might be 30 years. And you pay your premium every month or year, what have you, whatever the contract says. And they say, okay, if you die during this term, then we send such and such dollars to whatever beneficiary you name in the policy. And that's a pretty straightforward transaction. In contrast, the structure of what's called a whole life insurance policy means the contract says you keep paying your premiums to the life insurance company, and then they know for sure, as long as you keep that policy in force, they're going to pay you either when you die or if you reach a certain age, might be like 121, then even if you're still alive, they're going to go ahead and send that benefit to you or the person you name the policy. So that's the structure of those things. So it's sort of like a term policy that's so long, you know, you're going to get paid if that's the way you want to think about it. But what's special about that whole life policy is because you're paying into it for so long and just the structure of these things, the longer you keep that policy in force, it's like a ticking time bomb for the insurance company, because they know the date at which they pay you keeps getting closer and closer, because they know they're going to have to pay you if you keep that thing in force. And so it has what's called a surrender value, where you can say, if you say to them, you know what, just let's end this thing. Just give me a spot value of cash right now and you'll be off the hook. And so there's formulas involved and so on. But the point is this thing ages, the surrender cash value keeps growing. So that's one way in which wealth builds inside of this thing. And then as an added feature, as Carlos mentioned, contractually, you are guaranteed the ability to receive loans from the insurance company with that cash surrender value serving as the collateral. So again, we realize we're throwing a lot of stuff at you guys, but we want to at least explain the basic mechanics of this thing. And so when this is what Nelson Nash realized, he said, wait a minute, you get one of these dividend paying whole life policies in place, the thing's building up cash value over time, and that's a bigger and bigger base upon which to, collateral on which I can make loans and take loans from the insurance company at guaranteed contractual interest rates. And so you can use that. So when you have a major purchase, you got to buy a car, your daughter's getting married, you want to retire and start going on cruises, Nelson Nash realized that you can take policy loans from the life insurance company. All right. So at this point, we've just explained this possibility, and you're probably thinking, well, I would have to run the numbers and see if that made any sense. And since nobody else was talking about this, I'm guessing it doesn't. But the point is, there's actually a lot there. It seems like it's this fairly innocuous thing. And in one sense, it is. It's perfectly simple, straightforward strategy. But the more we've studied it, the more sense it makes. And what's really critical about it, why it's so important in our present environment, is that it is in a different sector of the economy, that it is a very conservative old institution, life insurance. It's not some newfangled thing that, you know, you might not understand how it works. I'm not sure if it's got regulatory approval and so on, but yet it is far removed from the commercial banking and Wall Street Fed nexus. And so when other things are going to be getting into serious trouble, as we think is on the horizon, or it's actually happening as we speak, that we think this is a very solid conservative place to store your wealth.
Yeah, and we might ought to throw in there as well, Bob, is that the two original products in the life insurance industry was the term insurance product as well as the whole life product. And it was that way up until about 1960. Those are the only two. This is the way Americans used to save their money. I mean, Americans during that period of time understood this product very well. They either used a savings bank account to save money, or they used a dividend-paying whole life policy, or they might even buy government bonds. But that was basically all the choices they had. Of course, when Nixon took us off the gold standard and inflation was unleashed across the world, this is when we saw inflation really take root in the United States. And then, of course, people no longer were seeking to save money because of the inflation factor. And as time went on, the insurance companies, in order to compete with Wall Street, who was taking advantage of all these, higher interest rates that were being put out because of the inflation, began to create other types of life insurance product that were more conducive to the stock market. But the whole life product remained the same product all along. And today, there's probably 1,000 life insurance companies in the United States, most of which are stock companies, and perhaps 50 of those companies actually even carry the whole life product. And of those 50 that do have it, probably about 20 of those companies are mutual or mutual holding companies, and which those are the ones that we tell people are the ones that they ought to get this whole life product from, because when you do, the policy owner is also an owner of the mutual. So you get that additional benefit that that it's not only coming from a mutual life insurance company, it's more than just a product. You yourself are an owner of the company.
Well, that's great added information there. Well, folks, I think we're out of time for this episode 2 of the Laura Murphy Show. Remember, we're here just trying to whet your appetite. We're trying to steer people towards the website where we have all of this information spelled out in much greater detail, along with information on what the next step would be in case you want to see how can you apply this in your own life. Again, all of that is at laramurphy.com. That's L-A-R-A hyphen Murphy, M-U-R-P-H-Y.com. So thanks, everyone, for tuning in, and join us next time where we discuss the latest shenanigans coming from the Federal Reserve and the federal government and who knows what else, Wall Street. And we will see all of you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.